TSA treatment of transgender passengers, creating a new category of hurricanes, and meeting the new maestro. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A new ProPublica report highlights an aggressive mistreatment of transgender and non-binary folks by TSA officials. Are there protocols and training of airport security when dealing with different groups of people? Why isn't everyone treated equally? We'll talk to the reporter on the story. Also, Dorian broke records, being one of the two strongest storms ever in the Atlantic. And this has people thinking, maybe it's time to come up with a new category, a Category 6 storm. And we'll meet the new music director of the Palm Beach Symphony Orchestra. He's also joined the Frost School of Music and will be conducting a show this weekend. We'll learn more about South Florida audiences and their taste in music. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. LGBTQ advocates and allies have expressed concerns that the airport's Transportation Security Administration screening procedures aren't sensitive to transgender travelers. A new report by ProPublica and the Miami Herald looks at the limitations in TSA technology and the lack of training for TSA officers who deal with transgender individuals. The report features discriminatory experiences going through TSA from transgender and gender nonconforming individuals. Brenda Medina is a senior reporter, reporting fellow with ProPublica, and she co-wrote this report, and she joins us now. Brenda, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Luis. Hi.
You know what? ProPublica has a call out asking folks right now to share their experiences interacting with the TSA. Did you get a lot of people coming forward to share that those stories?
Yes, we got about 200 stories, 174 of those we used for the report. It was specifically about mistreatment at the airport checkpoints.
Tell me about some of the stories that you've seen come through. I mean, are they all similar?
They are similar. What we're seeing is that transgender and gender nonconforming people are being extra scrutinized at the airports. Some of them have been pressured to expose their genitalia in order to take a plane. Some of them have been taken to a private room and asked to disrobe, and their private parts have been put into question. And that's why we started looking into this and into the technology's limitations and everything that we found in the report.
You know, one of the accounts that you received was from someone named Olivia. And just like in the report for ProPublica, we're only going to identify Olivia by her middle name to protect her identity. And we got a few minutes here of a story that she shared with us. Let's take a listen.
So we get through the TSA line and, you know, we walk through the millimeter scanning equipment. And so I stuck my hands up, I turned, I walk forward, and lo and behold, on the little screen, they've got a little mark right where my genitals are. So the woman who was running the machine, she pats me down, feels up all around in my genital area. She then grabs one of those swabs and she wipes me there and runs it through the bomb testing machine. Came up negative, and so she said, I'm gonna have to do another pat down. She feels around, feels up in all those areas, and she tells me, I can't clear you. And I want to perform another inspection. Can we do this in the other room? So I said, okay, that's fine. And they take me to the back room, and my fiance at the time was left outside. So they give me another pat down of my genitals, and she says, I just can't clear you. And I asked, I mean, is it because you feel something there? You know, because that's my penis. And, you know, she gives this look like she saw a ghost. I mean, it's not a weapon. There's nothing there. I'm, you know, sorry to surprise you here, but, and she says, okay. And she walks out and she tells me she's getting a supervisor. So I wait there. And then, two of, the TSA agents come in. And then the supervisor comes in. So the supervisor explains to me you know, because you're transgender, we're going to have a male specialist or some sort of other male TSA agent come down and inspect your genital area. And the implication was a lot more than just a pat down. You know, and also, you know, I don't see myself as a man. I don't see myself in that way. And so having some sort of inspection by a man was kind of scary to me. And so the supervisor then said, okay, well, we're going to escort you out of the airport. And, you know, at this point in time, they had not presented the situation as in, well, we're going to get the specialist for a genital inspection, or you're going to have to leave the airport. It was more of, you complained about this, and so fine, we're going to throw you out. And I said, this is completely wrong. And I got a little bit upset at this point in time, I think pretty reasonably so. I didn't curse anyone out or anything. I just was very emphatic saying, you know, this isn't right what you're doing. And one of the TSA agents said to me, well, we're going to throw you out then for backtalk. So, you know, at this point in time, I'm thinking I'm going to miss my fiance's brother's wedding. And, you know, I mean, I'm imagining that we're going to be broken up after this. I mean, the flight leaves in like, you know, 15 minutes. You know, so even if I do get out of here, I don't even know if I can make it, but, and so, you know, they start walking out to get like a police officer to escort me away. And so I beg them, please, can I just show you, like, there's nothing here. There's nothing, there's no weapons. It's not dangerous. I can show it to you. And so the supervisor said, okay, if it's okay with my agents. And they both kind of nodded, and they just, all three of them just stood there staring. So I said, well, should I take it off now? And I forgot what they said, but it was scented it in some way, an audit or something. And so I take off my underwear and my skirt, and I pull it to the ground. And the three of them there were just staring.
That story is from Olivia, one of the women interviewed by Brenda Medina, senior reporting fellow for ProPublica. And Brenda is reporting on the limitations in TSA technology and training and the impact that's had on transgender and non-gender identifying individuals. Brenda, very difficult to listen to. How many stories did you hear that were like Olivia's story?
We heard from about half a dozen people. It was either something like in Olivia's case that she had to show her penis, or we also heard from transgender male who was one specifically who had to disrobe and take his binder off and show his chest and to TSA officers.
Do we know if these are common occurrences or if they're rare?
We don't know. We found out that most people don't complain with the TSA. Even when most people don't complain, we realize that problems with gender and TSA screening, there's an overrepresentation in complaints with the TSA, because estimates indicate that transgender people make up roughly 1% of the population, but 5% of the complaints that TSA gets, civil rights complaints, are from transgender people related to these problems.
What has the TSA said about these complaints?
They say that they screen everyone equally, and they indicate that there are some limitations with that technology, and there were some limitations with the training that they've been trying to address. But the LGBTQ community has been complaining about this for nearly a decade, and it hasn't been resolved.
Let's talk about TSA protocol and this screening of passengers and how that's supposed to work. I mean, what's the protocol when somebody comes through? And, you know, we've all traveled, so we know we have to either go through a machine or they pat us down. But just remind us of what they're supposed to do and what they're allowed to ask us.
Yeah, so many people have been surprised by this part of our story. I was surprised as well when I learned this. But when we get in line and we take our shoes off and put our stuff through the x-ray machine, and we are about to walk into the scanners, the full body scanners, a TSA officer on the other side has to press a male or female button. And they have a split second to guess your gender. And sometimes that's not that easy. You know, some people don't conform to traditional, you know, gender norm ideas. And so sometimes we heard not only from transgender and gender nonconforming people, we heard from cisgender women who have short hair and they're scanned as male. And then the machine reads them as male. They see something that is not supposed to be there because the machine is programmed to only read male and female bodies in a way that is, you know, more traditional, if you will. And so they get a pat down. And sometimes in cases like Olivia's, that can escalate to being taken to a private room and pressure into showing your genitals to strangers.
Listening to Olivia's story the whole time, I kept thinking to myself, at any point, aren't TSA officials just trained in any way to ask, okay, I think you are a male or female, but how do you identify before we move forward? Did they ever think of asking, are they allowed to ask that question?
They are. So in the new training that TSA rolled out this year, they ask TSA officers to, whenever they can't tell someone's gender, to ask people what pronouns they use. We found a TSA private group on Facebook in which we found we read TSA officers complaining about that. They feel uncomfortable asking that question, or they think people are going to react in a negative way to that question. The truth is, many of them told us if they had better technology and machines that were not gendered, where they didn't have to guess someone's gender, they wouldn't have to go through all of this in the first place. It's a source of stress for the transgender community and the gender nonconforming community, and it's also stressful for the TSA workers.
Yeah. So this comes down to, in a lot of cases, these body scanners and what they can and what their limitations are as to what they can identify. Did the TSA say anything about upgrading these machines or changing them out for something better?
They told us that they have been exploring new technology that is gender neutral, or that, you know, you don't have to pick a gender at all, but they didn't give us a timeline for when they would have the new technology. And like I said, they have known about this issue for 9-10 years. So
again, I'm talking with Brenda Medina, senior reporting fellow with ProPublica and formerly a reporter with the Miami Herald. ProPublica and the Miami Herald have a new report that looks at the limitations in TSA technology and, of course, the insufficient training for its officers. The report features discriminatory experiences from transgender and non-binary officials, or excuse me, individuals. Brenda, you know, again, talking about these scanners, and one of the other things, too, that you point out is that They can discriminate against people of color. Are transgender people the only ones who've had to deal with uncomfortable experiences with these scanners, these machines?
No. So we actually came to this story because I wrote another story about how the machines can't read certain hairstyles, and they are braids or dreadlocks or sister locks or afros.
You said hairstyles.
Yes.
Okay. Please continue. Explain this to me. This is very strange.
Yeah. So apparently the machines have difficulties or limitations with reading mass, volume. And so if you have a lot of hair, it can't trigger an alarm. It can read it as something hiding under, you know, your hair, and so you get a hair pat down. The TSA gets a lot of complaints, particularly from Black women, about this, because some of the hairstyles that the machine has issues with reading are mostly associated with Black women, like braids and locks or afros. And so we wrote about that, and in the process we learned that it is also a problem for the trans community. Some people who are obese, you know, they also have issues. People who have some sort of medical device, external medical device, people with disabilities, like people in wheelchairs, for example. So, yeah, there are different populations that are affected by the limitations in this technology.
You know, since the report has come out, I mean, have you heard from TSA or anybody who's worked with TSA or even used to work for TSA?
We heard from people who works with TSA and used to work for TSA, including we interviewed the former director, Peter Neffinger, who told us that when he got in his position, when he became director of TSA, he met with advocates in the transgender community, and he realized pretty early on that it was an issue. He was in his job for about a year and a half, right before the Trump administration, but he did admit to us that he learned that these systems should be as close to like being able to read everyone as possible in order for people to trust the security system at airports.
Do you know anything about the diversity within the TSA? I mean, you know, like their employees, do they have a diverse, staff of people that people who would be a little bit more considerate and understand these challenges?
They do. I believe it's one of the most diverse agencies in the federal government. But, you know, the people who work doing these screenings, they told us they're confused. You can tell by their conversations in the private Facebook group. The TSA wouldn't tell us a lot about the training itself. But we learned from the conversations that they have in the private Facebook groups that many of them don't know what to do. They're told what to do on paper, but it's different when you are in front of a person and you have to do something that you know they are going to dislike. And, you know, the TSA officers that we interview again and again said that they wish the technology didn't require them to have to decide what gender someone is.
Yeah. Have you spoken with anyone in the LGBTQ community who might have a take on how to help TSA officials not feel so uncomfortable and to help them understand the best way to talk to somebody?
So there are LGBTQ organizations, specifically transgender rights advocates, who have been involved with the TSA. They have been going to roundtables and helping and assisting with training for some years now. They've been the ones talking to the TSA about these issues since the TSA started using this technology. So they have been involved and have reached out to the TSA, have been in communication with the agency.
You know, listening to you talk about, your reporting on the scanners and some of the challenges, I'm wondering if you've had the chance to ask the TSA, I mean, how successful are these scanners in finding actual objects that might be, a threat?
The TSA says that they are successful. A few years ago, there was this controversy because apparently Homeland Security, they did a test and the scanners didn't detect most of the weapons that were sneaked through. But the TSA also wouldn't tell us the false alarms rates for these scanners. They wouldn't make it public. ProPublic hasn't been the only news organization that has asked about this, and they don't make that information public. But they say it is the best technology that they have available at the moment.
So you're still collecting stories. You're still asking people to come forward and share their experiences with the TSA. What's next in the reporting on this story? Where do you go from here?
We'll see. We did the call out so that we could get the testimonies for this story. We'll see if anything else comes up. We're hoping that there is some kind of answer to this report, and that hopefully things are gonna move faster and at the TSA so that they can update the technology so that it's fair to everyone.
And again, going back to what you were saying earlier, is that there is a conversation within the TSA, right, about looking into these scanning machines and maybe perhaps that they're not as good as advertised and maybe there needs to be something else.
Yes, and they say they're exploring this. The company that makes the technology said that they are working with the TSA to move away from the gender buttons, but we don't know. Again, we don't know when that's going to happen.
Do we know by any chance, Brenda, if anywhere else in the world, perhaps security in European countries, in the Far East, that somebody may have a better system, perhaps, where this isn't an issue?
We know from previous ProPublica coverage of these machines when they first started using them that some countries in Europe decided not to use the machines because they found their false alarm rate to be high. I have read about similar issues with in the transgender community in countries in Europe as well, where transgender people going through airport checkpoints have faced similar negative experiences.
We've been talking with Brenda Medina, Senior Reporting Fellow with ProPublica, formerly of the Miami Herald. ProPublica and the Miami Herald have this new report out that looks at the limitations in TSA technology and the insufficient training for TSA officers. And the report specifically features discriminatory experiences that folks in the transgender and non-binary community are experiencing when they have these confrontations, I guess, with TSA officials. You can find a link to the report on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Brenda, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, do we need to create a new category for hurricanes? Did Dorian make us realize maybe there needs to be something even stronger? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Hurricane Dorian was one of the most powerful storms to hit the Atlantic in recorded history. It had maximum sustained winds of 185 miles per hour. Now, that's a Category 5 storm. But Dorian's got people talking, some people, that maybe we need a new category because we're seeing stronger and stronger storms. Now, a Category 5 has wind speeds of 155 miles per hour or higher. But again, in the last decade, we were seeing storms with 170s, 180s, 190s. Would a new category be necessary? Well, we spoke with the Miami Herald's climate reporter, Alex Harris, about this issue. So Alex, you know, the current scale that we use is based on the Saffir-Simpson scale, but help us remind us what that is and how it came to be.
So the Saffir-Simpson scale is actually designed by wind engineers really to determine the damage to physical infrastructure. So are your windows going to break? Are your walls going to collapse? Are your doors coming in? It really only measures wind.
So we talked with Hugh Willoughby yesterday, the professor from FIU, about this idea of a Category 6. This is what he had to say about that.
Categories, they're good for two things. If you're writing a paper about hurricanes, that gives you the bends for your histogram. The other thing it does is it communicates the level of danger. Five is a lot bigger than one. But if I say 110 knots and 160 knots, for people who don't think about this all the time, they're both a lot of wind. What happens when you hear those numbers is that's a big number. But on the other hand, so it's a communications thing. And I think it's one of those things where you might want to think about it, but this is something that works pretty well, and there are other problems like distinguishing the storm surge and the freshwater flood the same way we do wind with categories.
All right, so what have you heard, Alex, from researchers and hurricane experts about this idea, and where did the idea even come from?
So the idea of creating new categories for a 6 or even a 7 for storms is something that kind of floats around on the internet every time we have a really intense set of storms. It kind of originally was born after the 2005 series of hurricanes, which anyone who lived in Florida back in 2004, 2005 very clearly remembers. But they were hitting some really high wind speeds, and people started to wonder, is this something do we need new categories for? And it's something that climate change activists have really started to talk a little bit about and say, you know, as we start to see the impacts of a warming world on hurricanes, maybe it's time for some new categories.
But as you mentioned, the scale that we use right now really is looking at wind. But, you know, we heard from Willoughby say, what about the rain? What about the storm surge? Are other intangibles involved?
When I talk to experts about the creation of a Category 6, they say if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If you're going to change anything, you should change the way we communicate flood risk to people, because storm surge is the number one killer in hurricanes. As we see with Dorian moving up the coast right now, there aren't a ton of dangers out there for wind, but there's quite a bit of danger out there for storm surge moving up the coast. And the current Saffir-Simpson scale does not reflect that at all.
Now, you have sent a Freedom of Information request to NOAA, I believe, right?
Right.
You haven't heard back from them, but what information are you looking for and what are you hoping to find?
We heard some that they may be considering or at least having the conversation about the possibility of creating new categories. So we wanted to see, because generally when we talk to people, it's really hard to find a scientist who thinks it's a good idea to create a Category 6. Regardless of how strong climate change may make storms in the future, for a communication standpoint right now, it really does its job. 5 is as strong as it gets, and they don't want people to start to discount storms.
Do we have any idea why NOAA wants to possibly create another category?
It's just something we heard when we were checking it out. We don't know any of the ideas behind it or if it's actually true. We're just looking for the information.
Did you find any researchers who are vehemently against the idea of creating a Category 6?
No, but most of them are pretty much against it now. I think if there were, their concerns are really that if we were to create a Category 6, people would stop paying attention to 5s or 4s. You know, the way Floridians talk about hurricanes now is if it's less than a Category 3, it doesn't matter. They're worried people will take it less seriously if they add another category.
Has anybody ever told you, any researchers told you, that they're concerned that storms are getting stronger and that maybe the day will come when we're going to see a storm with maximum sustained winds over 200 miles an hour?
Yes, actually, one of the clearer signals research has found between the impact of a warming world under climate change and hurricanes is intensity. There's a lot of factors that go into climate science and hurricanes, but one of the stronger ones does appear to be that we will see not more storms altogether, but it's more likely that we'll see more Category 4s and 5s in the future. And yes, those storms could have even higher winds, so we could see something in the 200-mile-per-hour range.
You know, after the story was published by the Miami Herald, I wonder if you've heard from any of your readers and their thoughts on the idea of adding a new category.
So far, no. We've heard some people say, no, we don't need one. We've heard some people say, you know, the categories are fine. A 5 is bad enough. But it's pretty early in the day, so if anyone has feelings, they're welcome to tweet or email at me.
Have you heard anything from readers about how they change their preparation depending on the category? Because as you said, and I've seen some of the memes, too, from people here, you know, if it's less than a 3, I'm not even worried about it. But have you heard anything about how the category, I guess, changes the way people prepare?
So one of the good things, when I talked to Hugh Willoughby as well, one of the things he said worked really well with the Category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 scale is that people kind of instinctively understand that 1 means, you know, maybe some minor property damage, but 5 is devastation. And it's really an easy way to communicate with people who don't pay a lot of attention to hurricanes. And there are ways to communicate, you know, higher wind speed or flood by other methods. But I think Hurricane Irma freaked people out, and I think it made them more likely to pay attention when they heard another monster storm was headed our way. I don't know if people evacuated as much for this one as they did for Irma, but so far we're still trying to figure out the differences between that storm and this storm and how people prepared.
And, you know, just thinking, too, that Florida has some really strict building code because of hurricanes. How much does the scale play into, you know, the way we build our buildings?
That's actually a really good question, because Category 5 usually means anything over 156-mile-per-hour winds. And we've heard from the Prime Minister of the Bahamas, which was devastated by Hurricane Dorian, that all of their buildings, and they have some of the best storm building codes in the world. They were all built to Category 5, or many of them were. And he said that that's 150 miles per hour, but they were bombarded with 185-mile-per-hour winds. So it might be time to think about if we need to level up or think about changing the building codes to be stronger for stronger storms in the future.
And of course, the other thing is the fact that Dorian just kind of sat there.
Right.
It was a powerful storm, but it also just sat there for a long time. Alex Harris of the Miami Herald, always appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that was a conversation we actually had with her last week. We talked to her from the studios of WLRN at the Miami Herald in Doral. And you know what we want to hear from you? What do you think about the idea of adding a new category to storms? Is five enough? Or do you think now we have to go to six? Well, we've heard from some of you. Cayman Antonio Haidari tweeted at us, is a new category of hurricanes needed, a Cat 6? I've been through a few, and I don't think so. Hurricane Dorian and Hurricane Harvey show a second metric needed for flooding. Like gymnastics and diving, give wind metrics and water scores. Barbara Garcia Blanca tweeted us, the forces of nature could be so mind-blowingly terrifying. Yes. Yes, they can. But find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know your thoughts. If a forecaster came on television and said a storm just reached Category 6, how would that make you feel? Love to hear your thoughts. Well, still to come, a prolific classical music maestro has two new gigs here in South Florida. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, let's talk about music. We heard a little bit just a little while ago. We heard, actually, I believe it was from the Seattle Symphony Orchestra performing Brahms' Second Symphony. It's conducted by maestro Gerard Schwartz. And Schwartz has led a long celebrated career in the world of classical music, starting as the co-principal trumpeter in the New York Philharmonic. He's gone on to become music director of numerous iconic festivals and conduct among the most prestigious orchestras around the globe. And he recently became the member of the Frost School of Music faculty. His first performance is this Saturday. Schwartz has also been named the new music director of the Palm Beach Symphony Orchestra. Joining us now in studio, Mr. Schwartz, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
By the way, I mean, welcome to South Florida. I should say that.
It's wonderful to be in South Florida, I must say.
Well, you're going to find out how wonderful it is in the wintertime, I promise that. What brought you here? What attracted you to South Florida? Because, I mean, a person like you, really, doors could be open anywhere.
Thanks for that. It was the weather. I'm looking forward to how beautiful it's going to be in January. Actually, I like it. I like the heat, so I love it now. So I'm very happy. But everything I've always done in my life has always been for a musical reason. So when I went to Seattle, for example, where I spent 28 years, they said, oh, you're coming here because it's so beautiful, the mountains and the water, and even though it rains a lot, it certainly... And I said, no, I came because of the orchestra. So it's not dissimilar here. When the Frost School asked me to come down and spend a week conducting the orchestra last season, I just fell in love with the orchestra. I fell in love with the environment. It's a fantastic music school. And they asked me to apply, which I did, and I then have now become a member of the faculty. So I really came here because I'm dedicated to teaching, something I've always loved, and because the atmosphere is so incredible at the school, and that's really why I came.
I've always wanted to ask this question. I always love asking this question, I should say, of artists when they come here, is how is South Florida viewed in the music world?
Well, it's of course a changing question because it has developed so much over recent years. You know, when we think about the history of South Florida, a lot of visiting orchestras. I've come here many times when I was in the New York Philharmonic, when I was in Seattle, we toured here with mostly. I've been here a lot, as any musician who tours would, but it's been a little difficult getting footholds for symphonic music here. Cleveland came here, of course. The Florida Philharmonic disbanded at some point. You have the great school that Michael Tilson Thomas runs. But what's happened in recent years is more and more because of the art world, because of the theater world, because of the music world, South Florida has become a real destination rather than just a place for what you guys call snowbirds, I guess, right?
Okay, so not just for audiences, but also for performers, because, I mean, you know, I wondered, like, some of the stories that you heard from the students that you've been working with, you know, what attracted them to this
I think
area?
What attracted them to the school is the incredible faculty. Most students in a music school come for the teacher. If they want to study with Aaron Tindall, who's our soloist, he's one of the great tuba players in the world, one of the great teachers, and people are beating their door down to come and study tuba with him. Now, the fact that it's here and it's so beautiful, and the rest of the faculty is so extraordinary and so imaginative and so far thinking, led by one of the great leaders in the world of music education and music in general, Shelley Berg, a great pianist, a great jazz artist, a great arranger, a great composer, but he's an innovator in the way he approaches music education. And so what happens here at the Frost School is that there's so much flexibility. You can be a tuba player and you want to play in a symphony orchestra, but then you can also learn about jazz. You can learn about contemporary music. You can be a part of a recording facility or learn about copyrights or learn about anything that in the music world with a kind of fluidity that no other school has.
So I'm wondering, like, is it more the program? Because, I mean, from what you said, sometimes if it's the right teacher, people want the teacher.
Right.
Really more than anything.
They come for the teacher and then they find this unbelievable program. Now, of course, there are times when people will come for the program as well, especially in music education, musicology, music theory, things like that. But performers, people who are instrumental majors, you know, a clarinet major or a trumpet major or a violin major, they come for the teacher primarily.
Do we have the infrastructure here to really, you know, to train these elite musicians?
Yes, not only do we have the infrastructure to train the elite musicians, we all know that everybody can't be the next Lang Lang or Yo-Yo Ma, and so we're training them on very different levels. Yes, if you want to be Lang Lang, one of the great pianists alive, we'll train you to do that. We have a phenomenal piano faculty for that. But if for some reason you don't get that opportunity, there are many other levels of education that we're dealing with. So it's not you become the greatest pianist in the world or you better get into another field. I mean, it's a unique place and an extraordinary place, and that's why I'm here.
You started as a trumpeter, also tuba, right?
I was out as a trumpeter.
Okay, as a trumpeter. What drew you to that instrument?
Everyone who plays a musical instrument is drawn to it for a personal reason or because their parents made them. the mother says, you must play the piano. You must play the piano. So when I was five, my mother made me play the piano and my sisters, and we played the piano. But my parents were from Austria, and they were very, very involved and committed to the arts. I would say next to their medical practices, the arts was the most important thing in their lives. And they were doctors, and they took us to the Philharmonic, took us to the opera, we were very, very lucky. We lived just outside New York City. They took us to see a movie called Aida by Giuseppe Verdi, the movie version, and I heard those herald trumpets in the triumphal scene in the last act, and I was seven, and I said, that's what I want to play that. And my mother, who was a psychiatrist, who actually knew Freud, you know, so here's my said, my son's going to be a whistleblower playing the trumpet? Forget it. And she called me a whistleblower until I got into the New York Philharmonic.
And then finally she accepted.
Finally, she still didn't accept it, but what was fascinating is that when she tells the story, when she was pregnant with me, she had continuous dreams that I would be a conductor. How's that?
Wow.
And I think that's why I avoided it for so many years.
Well, you know what, because that led me to this other, I mean, so you've played in symphonies, but you've been a conductor, you're now an educator, and I'm wondering, you know, do you have a preference? Is there one that you feel more natural to doing?
Well, we musicians, most of us, are educators. I mean, when I was a trumpet player, I taught at Juilliard and I taught at other schools. As a conductor, I started a wonderful conducting program at a summer festival I run in North Carolina at the Eastern Music Festival. So we all do. I don't know of any distinguished musician who doesn't teach and give back. What I'm doing now that's different than that is I've made a real commitment. It's not, oh yes, come and take some lessons and that's fine. But I'm actually on the faculty. I am full-time. I live here. And this is, in a sense, my next mountain. You know, my first mountain was to become a trumpet player. I wanted to be in the New York Philharmonic, and I got that. Then my next mountain was to be music director of a major orchestra, which I did in Seattle, and we helped build the hall there, and I committed my life. And then when I left Seattle, the next mountain I wanted to climb was to try to have an influence in exposing and educating an audience, to expand the audience. So I started the All-Star Orchestra, which is an orchestra from musicians all over the country. And we've now won 7 Emmys with our TV series. We have 7 million students on the Khan Academy. So I think I'm making a little dent in that educational, the idea of trying to educate people, mostly young people, but older people as well, and to expose them to great music. So now the next one is to be on the faculty of a major, maybe in my estimation, the most important music school in the country, an incredible environment. And besides that, I get to live here. Think of that. It's not bad. You get up every morning and you look outside and it's gorgeous. My wife said to me, oh, look at the sky. Look at, you know, the pinks and the blues. And I mean, you know, we're New Yorkers. The view from our apartment in New York is of brick buildings. And here we look outside and it's all greenery. And it's a real joy.
Again, I'm talking with Gerard Schwartz, the maestro and conductor, recently joined the Frost School of Music faculty. He became the music director for the Palm Beach Symphony Orchestra. And you can see his debut performance conducting this weekend at the Frost School of Music. We have details on our website, WLRN.org. What are the differences that you see in audiences, though, for classical performances? You know, as you said, like part of South Florida for a long time, it was just snowbirds. But the area has grown so much that you don't have to wait for the winter.
Well, here we are, yeah. Saturday night.
Right.
We're giving our first concert. This is September. You know, yeah. There are those people that think that you can't do any concerts in South Florida until January because there isn't anyone here. Well, my wife and I live in Coral Gables, and in our neighborhood, every house is occupied by someone. They're not empty waiting for the weather to change. Now, it doesn't mean that some people have homes there that live in Boston or right. or Chicago or whatever. But it has changed dramatically. And as far as the audience, I don't know the answer because I'm new. I do believe that we will make, over a period of time, a tremendous impact with programming and with great soloists and with great performances. I've always had this idea that the most important thing we can do as performers is to give great concerts. You give great concerts that are moving and exciting, people will come and people will support you. If the concerts are not on a high level, why would they bother? You know, they could stay home and listen to a fine CD. And I feel that way. I'm sorry to say, sometimes going to concerts, people say, oh, what's wrong with the audience? I say, there's nothing wrong with the audience. But on occasion, there's something wrong with what's going on stage. Just because you're playing Beethoven doesn't mean that you're going to move the audience.
So it sounds like concerts right now seem to be almost more important than the recorded piece because, I mean, the audiences want a new experience.
I agree. I think so. I mean, of course, I'm a big recording person. You know, I have 350 recordings I've made. But, and I love recording. I mean, it's fun for me, and I love listening to recordings. But there is nothing like the experience of a live concert. And I go to concerts all the time. Here, at the Guzman Hall at the university, my wife and I are going to, I think, 8 concerts over the next 2 weeks. You know, I looked in the catalog of what's going on there. So I got tickets for everything. I mean, we could stay home and watch TV, you know. So given the, not that I'm against TV, please don't say, but given the choice, I'm going to be in Guzman listening to great music. I went to the Mancini Institute concert the other night. It was fantastic. I mean, what an opportunity.
You know what? One of the things I wanted to mention, too, it was a welcoming statement of your arrival to the Palm Beach Symphony Orchestra. Executive Director David McClymont, I hope I'm saying that right.
Yep.
He said, quote, I'm confident he'll take you, will take the Palm Beach Symphony Orchestra to new heights, attracting more diverse audiences in the greater Palm Beaches and expanding our reputation across South Florida. What does that diversity look like? I mean, because you talked about it a little bit a while ago, it's you're trying to educate audiences, but you also mentioned younger audiences.
Well, you know, I like all audiences. I don't care what their age. I like old audiences, right, and I like young audiences. We in our world all say, oh, we have to worry about the young audience. Well, yes, we do, of course. You do that by educating. You do that by exposing people. But think of it. You're 25 years old. Your great passion in life is not going to symphonic concerts. You like it. You've been exposed. You've been experienced. But you're looking to have a long-term relationship with someone. So you ask him out on a date, and you go and sit in a concert for 2 hours where you can't talk. Not likely. You're going to go out to dinner, or you're going to go someplace where you can have a chat and where you can have a drink. Or let's take it further. You're now have a relationship, and you have children, and you work really hard. And at night you come home, and you're exhausted. And on occasion you get to spend a night with your family. Do you say, oh, I'm not going to spend the night with my kids tonight, I'm going to go to the concert? No, I have a daughter who's a surgeon, and her husband's a surgeon. They're great music lovers, and they don't go to the symphony because they have two sons. When they're not on call doing surgery, they want to spend it with their family. Can you blame them? But when they get older, they will. They have the exposure, they have the love, and they will come. So the diversity we talk about, of course, is we care, as we all do. We care about people, everyone, rich, poor, young, old, Hispanic, African American. We're trying to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to come and be exposed. That's not easy to do, but we're trying.
I wonder too, from your take, is you've been now doing this for so many years, and you've seen how technology has changed the music scene. And so now, and this may be to how you reach some of these audiences, now it's not just publishing your music, isn't just printing it on an album. It's putting it up on Spotify. It's putting it up online. It's, you know, making sure you're on social media to connect with people. Do you like that? Do you like how things have changed?
Yes and no. I love connecting with people. So I have a big Facebook presence. I do Facebook Live, and I get, you know, 15, 20,000 people on occasion listening to, you know, a discussion between me and other conductors and other soloists. And I mean, it's really, it's fun for me, and it's fun to be able to do that and realize that you're going to reach however many thousands of people. The negative side is careers in our world used to be made by CDs. Now, they weren't big numbers like pop CDs,
right,
but they were. So if you had a record company, if anybody can remember RCA and Columbia Records, if you have those companies behind you, you had a chance of promoting yourself and making a career. Nowadays, you don't have record companies that do that. And as a result, I find it very difficult to get young artists some traction. And think about the great superstars now. How many in our world of classical music do we have? 3 or 4 or 5?
Right.
And after that, we have artists who are equally great, but they don't have the traction because they don't have that kind of support.
I wanted to, if we could, I think we can get here real quickly, listen to an excerpt from the Brahms Second Symphony. This was performed by the Seattle Symphony Orchestra. This was conducted by you. What can people expect at the concert? I just had to play a little something of yours, but what can people expect?
Well, I think you talk about diversity. We have a very diverse program. So the Brahms Second Symphony is one of the great masterpieces of traditional repertoire. This is music that people have all heard. Anyone who is a classical music fan has heard this piece. If you haven't heard this piece, it is one of the great works of art, period. I mean, it's touching, beautiful, and exquisite. But we also have two other pieces on that are less well known that I'm confident the audience will love. Alberto Ginastera's ballet suite, Estancia, the Argentinian composer, a phenomenal composer, died in 83, so it's been a while. And his star has kind of passed. When he was alive, people listened to his music a lot. after he died, not so much anymore. And yet the music is infused with this kind of rhythm that comes from his native land and his and the dynamism that he had as a person. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece. And then we have a work by a living American. Samuel Jones wrote this incredible tuba concerto. Now, you don't get tuba concertos very often. So just the fact that you're going to see Aaron Tindall walk out carrying a tuba is something unusual and very special. You hear him play. There's nothing like the sound of this. I mean, as a solo instrument, how exciting, by a living composer.
Gerard Schwartz is the maestro and conductor of the Frost School music faculty and the music director of the Palm Beach Symphony Orchestra. You can see his debut performance conducting this weekend at the Frost School of Music. Details are on our website at WLRN.org. And Gerard, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate it. And you know what? For symphonies, what do they say? Good luck. Have a good show.
I mean, you can say anything you want.
Have a great show. Well, I know I can't tell an actor. I got to tell him break a leg.
No, that's right. Very good. No, I want my legs and have to stand.
Have a great show. Thank you so much. I really
great
appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, September 10th. I just want to remind everybody, by the way, that we do have a book club. We are reading our book this month. Hopefully that you will be able to join us on that. Find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. We're reading Miami Midnight by Alex Segura. By the way, we're going to have a Facebook chat with him tomorrow at 7 p.m. online. So go there now. Join for free. We'd love to have you and start posting your questions. Again, you can always find us online at WLRN.org or on social media, Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.